So here we are with this catching the bull. I want to talk a little bit about what I talked about last time. Just a little bit, but you know, I also want to frame this a little wider than just where I was the last time. So I think the last time, to me, the most important part about these ox herding stories is that each of these pictures, you have to think of them as a story. Each of these pictures are self-contained. The whole of the practice or the whole of the stage is in that one story. And so it's not, if we think of it as this progressing story, so it's one story that progresses through different frames, then we're always trying to get to the end. We're always trying to get to picture 10 or picture 9 or whatever. And we evaluate these early pictures as lesser than stages. So this is the wimpier stages, and I need to get to that emptiness or something because that's where it's all at. But actually, they're called ox herding stories. And I think it's because each one of these 10 stories is a story in and of itself. It's not a part of a whole. It is the whole. And so the whole has within it both the inspiration that inspires us in this stage of our practice, and it has the challenges that come within our practice. And we want to begin to know both of those. We want to know at a particular stage in my practice, what's the gift of it and what's the downside to it? So I think I talked a lot about usually whenever I talk about the ox, I always think of the ox in a very, you know, like a wholesome, altruistic, beautiful, loving, just the best ever space. I always think of it as my better side. So if I get empty, the goodness in me is going to come out. So I just can't wait till I get more and more and more samadhi because the goodness comes out. And then Philip Moffitt and I were talking at a retreat, I think it was last month. And he said something. We were talking about a particular teacher that I love dearly, Trungpa Rinpoche, and we were talking about him and all of the negative, horrific press that he has, you know, in his life, how bad things were, the drinking and some of the traumatic ways he has, he treated some of his students and the, you know, the difficulties with women. I mean, it's just a lot of bad press. And I said, I don't understand how someone, because at the same time he had all this bad press, you know, Trungpa Rinpoche brought just an enormous amount of people into the Dhamma. And the wisdom that he expelled for many, many people was striking. And so there's this edge here that I was saying, I don't understand how someone with that level of awareness could also equally cause that much damage. And he said that, you know, the further you go up into awakening and emptiness, morality kind of gets, there's a thin line here about morality. And we were, I mean, Philip wasn't saying there's no morality, but what he was, what I was beginning to kind of, I'll talk from my perspective rather than from Philip's, but from my perspective, what I begin to understand is that morality is a egoistic opinion, right? This is what I think is the right way to be. Whoever's doing all that killing of people over the weekend a few weekends ago, they had a morality, a code of morality that said, for the civil good, I should go out and kill a whole bunch of people. I don't understand that, but that is a moral code in some people's lives. So there's a fine line here. I'm beginning to realize that's what I want to talk about. This fine line around this assumption that if I awaken, I will necessarily be nice. You understand what I'm saying here? We just assume we're going to be nice. We assume we're going to be the good people. We're going to be the good guys. We're awake. Right? We're going to be the nice people. We're going to do everything good. But when you're awake and you're not identified, then there's a fine line here as to whether or not your behavior comports with the way society sees behavior. And you could go off the rails, so to speak. I don't really want to talk tonight about whether we're going to go off the rails. I want to point to this picture that articulates the gift that's in this picture. And I begin to think about this picture in a completely different way. So if morality is an egoistic thing that we decide individually or culturally or from our family, what is the right way to be? How are good people and how are bad people? Who's right and who's wrong? If we decide all this, the moral grounds, it's not universal. It's our own upbringing. Then what happens if that's stripped away? What happens if the view gets stripped away? And this genuine self that we're looking at, the ox, this genuine self doesn't have that kind of inherent code within it. So just consider that. What if the ox itself, it doesn't have that kind of genuine code? Do you know the movie I, Robot? It's from a movie fanatic. Some of you might know it, some of you don't know it. Well, in I, Robot, it was a Will Smith movie. The world was way in the future, sci-fi, which I love. And so in this movie, they had all these robots that did things and they made decisions and they decided things, but they realized that human beings had too much moral energy around it. So they used these robots to kind of make decisions. So they take the human error out of it is what they did. And Will Smith, who was a cop, didn't like robots because he got into a car accident one time. And in that car accident, the robot decided that he had a better chance of living than a little girl. And so he let the robot let the little girl die and saved Will Smith. And so, of course, Will Smith now got all this trauma issue that, and of course, he's a cop and he's got to try or investigate a crime, a murder committed by a robot. It was so perfect. Anyway, the point I'm making is that if you take away some of our moral codes, we can't guarantee that we're going to make choices that others would not see as harmful, that others would believe were not harmful. And this is what I want to point to on this picture. Maybe we should put the picture up so I can point a little bit to it. This is what I begin to notice about this picture. I've always looked at the yogi, that little retreatant, the practitioner, little tiny being as problematic. It's catching the ox there. That's the one it is. Yeah, that one. So I've always looked at that, the practitioner is so tiny in comparison to the enormity of this ox, this genuine mind. And that mind can pretty much, that self, that energy can pretty much send us in all kinds of directions. It can fling us up into the high altruistic places, and it can, oh yeah, there we go. Yeah, share the screen a little bit. So it can fling us into high places, and it can take us into deep ravines. This is what I'm talking about. This, who we are, is enormous, and the potentiality of what we can do is enormous. So if we do not pay attention to that, then we can cause harm. I'll give you an example. The stiller I began to get, the more samadhi I cultivated, I only thought of that samadhi in relation to meditation. So I'm very still and very dedicated and resolved in my meditation practice. That's the only way I ever thought about it. It never dawned on me that that energy is equally impactful if I get mad. If I get mad, I'm very still. So the anger is very condensed and it gets very pointed. If I look at you and I'm mad, I'm very still, very pointed. It's very intimidating. I never thought about that. I mean, usually if people are flailing about because they're mad, you're just like, whatever. You're like big drama. But if somebody got very still, very quiet, and they're mad and they're looking at you, you're going to feel that with a level of intensity that's very different. And I didn't pay attention in the beginning that my practice also needed me to correct my behavior and adjust my behavior, because I can cause way more harm. Ajahn Tomato brought this up. And when he was talking, he said that he began to realize that who he was as an abbot, he could see that his energy could affect everybody in that place's day, their moods, how they felt, everything. We get very impactful as we begin to practice, as the more we begin to open up to this possibility of our true nature, we can be very impactful on other people's lives. And so if we're not paying attention, we don't see that. We don't see the level of destruction we can actually have. But if you notice this yogi here, this practitioner, they really have a very thin rope. Very thin rope. It's them. And I begin to realize that it's in this human existence, meaning that our ego has the ability. What the Buddha found was that mindfulness, our human condition to be mindful, to pay attention, makes all the difference in the world. Just our willingness to pay attention and be mindful about what's happening is what can make all the difference between whether I cause harm or whether I am very, very supportive and helpful, non-harming. That paying attention to harm as a very simple, thin, almost unobscured, like barely noticeable thing. And yet if we use that as our gauge, that makes all the difference in the world. Mindfulness is such a kind of like a random term now. We use it like it's, you know, you can sell a car with it. It's nothing. Anybody can do it. It's so, you know, common. And a lot of practitioners I know, they will, especially on retreats, they will come to you and they're like, I want to get into jhana. I want to get into the big stuff. Get down deep. You know, not that little mindfulness stuff. It's just, that's the beginning stuff. But if you think about it, that mindfulness is like that little bitty tiny rope, little bitty thin thing that this human existence allows us to actually tame and train this massive mind. We do it with mindfulness. So here, the yogi in this picture, in the catching of the ox, is trying to tame this mind by force. And as we go further down, we're going to learn that the real taming comes through mindfulness. It doesn't come by force. It comes by being aware of what you're doing, what's happening. But here in this picture, because of our wanting to own this mind and control this mind, we try to do it by force. And in the course of our trying to do it by force, you have one force, which is you, and you have the force of your genuine mind. And yeah, I think the genuine mind, you can tell that ox is way bigger than us, our ego. And it's just pretty much, running us up and down, flinging us up to the high mountains and coming down in the ravines, just standing there. Like, what you going to do? What you got? What? And we know that. We know we try to fight that mind, and it's nothing. We do everything to keep from thinking about the same old craziness over and over and over. And once you get stuck in one of those loops, you know, it's like nothing. No matter what, you almost have to beg your mind to please stop talking about that. It ain't even listening. It's going to keep on going on and on and on and on. It doesn't matter how painful some of this thinking process is. It doesn't matter how much you want to cry to please stop. It will not. It will not. And yet mindfulness, this relatively simple paying attention, changes everything. So that's what I begin to see in this picture. So we're going to save some time so we have time to get into little groups. But I want to show you what my artistic expression is. I don't know if you can see it. I'm going to first put it up here. Yeah, we can take that down. Thank you, Khaled. So here's my expression. I'm going to see if I can show it. Where's the actual, oh, there it is. Okay, so I go this way. There you go. So can you see that? This is like a, I'll show you guys, just a second. You see what it is? It's like a, it's like a bamboo that's kind of twisted up. So then I'll let you guys see it. It's like this bamboo picture. This is my calendar picture for the month of, it was the month of March. All right. So this piece of bamboo, it's really one bamboo, I think, all twisted up in this knot. This is what the caption says. No matter how much you try to hold on to something, it will all be gone. This is what I think this month is kind of pointing to. It's pointing this picture of catching the bull. We try to catch it, hold on to it, grab it, control it, make it work for us. And it doesn't. It's not that kind of a mind. It's not that kind of a ox. It's not that kind of a situation. Sorry, you guys. So this is my expression. I want to see if you guys have yours. If you don't, we're going to put the picture back up and you can just look at it and share what you think. But I think I'd like us to get into groups three. Yeah, I think we can do groups of three here. We can do groups of three. So those of you online, we're going to put you in breakout groups of three. And then we're going to take about 20 minutes to talk about it. And then we will come back after. You know, you can talk about what you heard me say tonight, what you've been thinking about over the course of the month, just whatever has come to you around this idea of catching the ox. It could be that you come today for the first time this month and you look at the picture and you can just talk about what you think about the picture itself. So I'll see. I'll give us a moment. If you're not wanting to participate in the groups online, which I hope you will, but if you don't want to, I understand that also. You don't really get to do that inside the room. You pretty much have to. No, you don't. But if you want to bow out, you can say goodbye. You know, we'll see you next week. Oh, if you're coming next week, we're going to do a remembrance ceremony for Memorial Day. So maybe bring a least, you know, maybe think about someone you want to share the practice with. Susan and I are going to do a ceremony. All right. All right. Great. I hope you brought some artistic ways to express what we're learning here, because I think when we think about this on an artistic level, we can gradually make more sense to each other sometimes without words. There's a way that we can understand things in a felt sense from art that we can't always understand when we just use words. Even though you could use the words of a poetry or words of a song, it still carries with it the felt sense expression of that art rather than the words themselves. So I'll just see if anybody would like to share what they came to or what they wanted to share, your expression, whatever you'd like to share. I want to see if anyone wants to share their artistic expression, or at least what it felt like being in a room with people talking about this topic from art or from your felt sense experience of it, not from having to know something. Suze can't unmute. That's what I see, a little sign here that says.
You should be able to now, sorry.
Thank you, Dora. Dora, keep wanting to call you Dora.
I was just curious about what was so funny when you were muted.
Oh, I tried to mute the screen and turn off the mic so I could cough, but I actually turned the mic on, so it was already off. So it's been huge cough. Okay, Suze, can you?
Yeah, and I don't have anything to share, but Barbara Denard had her hand up, and I don't think she was able to unmute. And so I wanted you to know that she's online. Barbara, do you want to say something?
Oh, now I'm able to unmute.
Okay.
Thank you, Suze.
Well, I think when we started this, I had a kind of primitive idea about steps. So I think about stairs. And I really felt like you spoke to that tonight, Tweri, which, because I knew by the second ox herding picture that I had traits in common with that struggle that I had, and I could start to identify with the steps all the way through, just pieces of it. And I've been thinking that, I don't know if it was Lauren or Beth who was talking about it being in the pictures are in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
And that made so much more sense that parts of this cycle we would redo.
Yes. With other
things that could, and that it's part of the cycle of our lives and our growth. And so that was helpful.
Yes, that's right. Many of the pictures are not done in a linear format. They're done in a cycle, circle.
Yeah.
They're shown that way, I should say.
The linear sounds like what Ajahn Sumedha said yesterday about the mind. When the mind takes charge, we evaluate, we look at things more critically and probably more in a linear fashion.
Yeah, that's true. What do you guys think about this possibility, Alan, I'll get you, this possibility that our minds could do harm? You know, this fighting with this mind and before it's tamed, it's in this picture, not in the pictures that come afterwards after we've tamed it, but in this fighting of this mind that we could actually do harm. But Alan, you don't have to answer that question. You could just answer whatever you were going to say.
Thanks, Tweri. I'll go with that one. You know, I identify with this, like, this person with the rope trying to yank the mind around. Because my whole life I've been trying to control the mind, usually in the interest of being a good person. But, you know, I've done a lot of damage just by trying to control this mind. And I, you know, most of my life have been just really quiet, you know, introverted, trying to be nice and polite. And
that's how I see you too.
Things perfectly. And, you know, I had this moment I had to learn from where I just had somebody was pushing my button at the wrong time and I exploded at them. Unfortunately, it was somebody who I, you know, could work with and talk it through, but it was, you know, the shadow just like bursting out. Or the bowl, you know, and I guess this analogy, the bowl just being like, nope, I'm not going to have it anymore. And I whip you right around. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's good to, goodness is important and it's good to touch into goodness, but control, that control, I think is dangerous.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's what I think this picture is pointing to is that we're trying to control this mind. And I think we're going to find as we go along that the awareness is far more powerful than the control. That there is a way that the actual taming of this mind is a much more gentler process than the way we use the word control. So this mindfulness that we treat so commonly is actually quite powerful. I think if you did not go and hear Sumedha, you might want to consider that if we're going to have that audio, but. Yeah, so the audio, he actually said, I mean, the way he talked about mindfulness, even though it's a very common thing that we use, he still brought out just how powerful it is. That's what I think is so shocking about what the Buddha came with, because it's a really relatively simple thing. if someone tells you, just pay attention to the breath. It's sort of like, that's stupid. Anybody could do that. That can't possibly get me to enlightenment. And yet, it is a thin, tiny little rope that only a human conditioned being can do. If we were born in what's called hungry ghost realms, or even if you don't call them hungry ghosts, you don't believe in that. Just think of people whose lives are just so overwhelmingly problematic. They just can't sit and meditate. They just can't. They're too busy trying to survive to ever be able to just, you know, come to a evening and sit for 2 hours. Or people whose lives are so perfect, you know, they have everything going their way, everything's great. They are not trying to look into suffering. That's the last place they're trying to go. So the only people is this human condition where we're willing to both see the challenge and the goodness. And that is a very tenuous place to be in, because we're very vulnerable. And at the same time, we're very powerful. That's what I think this picture is pointing to. We can't control that, even though we want to. Oh, go ahead.
We've talked about a whole
You may have to use this mic though, because we can hear you, but they can't.
Okay. All right. Yeah, in our group, we talked about a whole bunch of things, but then we got down to the little thin rope. And what does the little thin rope attach to? The ox has a ring in their nose.
Mm-hmm.
So the ox is already tame.
It's already tamed?
Already, well, it allowed somebody, somehow it has a ring in its nose. So that could, the only way you can hold this big, powerful ox with that little thin rope, and maybe we can hold it. The art that I brought was about not even trying, is letting it go and then looking for it in the future. But something about this incredibly strong being is already tame and lets us hold it.
I guess I wouldn't say that it's already tamed, because we're going to have to do some whipping and some rope and tying as we go along. We're going to be doing some whipping with the rope. But you do note something here. It actually has the ability to be tamed. You see what I'm saying? Even though it's very powerful and very difficult for us, and it's hard to believe that my mind can be tamed, it can be, no matter how monkeying it is, no matter how much it seems to be never willing to stay on the breath, it can be tamed. That's what I think you're pointing out. Very nice. But we're going to have to do a little bit more whipping and fighting and carrying on before we actually, before we actually let go and have a relationship with this mind. We're not quite ready to love it the way that we can, right? That knowing it's tamed is kind of we have a relationship with it. And right now, we still are fighting it, thinking we can, it needs to do what we say. And it's a bit of a struggle here. But I do like that you've noticed that it can be. That is significant. Well, we'll see if there's one more. Okay, go ahead. Lori.
Hi. So in our group, we were having an interesting discussion among many other things, goodness. what is goodness? How do you know when you have goodness? You know, and the monk whose name I cannot remember from last night, yesterday.
Oh, Sumedho.
Sumedho was, you know, saying that, you know, it just is, right? And as you were talking about sort of the damage that our mind can do, if you can expand on that a little bit more, I think that would be helpful.
So the more we settle, the more we get connected to non-harm. And we can be extremely harmful in our non-harm because we get absolute in our view as to the way things should be. And if you're not mindful, so this is assuming that you're not being mindful. If you're mindful, you're going to pay attention to your behavior. But oftentimes, we're not aware, we're not using wise attention to think about what we're doing. So we don't see our self-righteousness actually causes harm to many, many, many beings because we are too connected to the non-harm of whatever. And so we have a hard time actually seeing the harm. Or we can get so caught up in our practice and our samadhi. You see this a lot with people who have strong concentration practices. They get so connected to the concentration practice that they can't even see how actually arrogant and rude and disrespectful they are to everybody else that's not doing what they're doing. And so there's a way in which just because you are cultivating mindfulness and you can move towards samadhi does not mean that the behavior is going to show up as kindness. That is a choice that as practitioners, I think Buddha actually targeted for his practitioners. There's a sutta, one of my lead suttas for conduct and kamma is the discourse on effacement. And in that sutta, the Buddha noted 8 levels of deep samadhi, deep concentration, 8 ways that you can be deeply aware or deeply present, complete unification of mind, jhanas, whatever you want to call it. And yet the Buddha said that was not what he would call effacement, which is what he said was the purpose of his practice, was the effacement or the diminishment, the elimination of greed, hatred, and delusion. And he said that no, these 8 extreme levels of concentration and practice, blissful states of samadhi, not one of them. He even said, one might think in that state that, yes, I have reached effacement, and they would be wrong. that is not effacement. And then when he said how to get to effacement had nothing to do with meditation as much as it had to do with knowing harm and not doing it, knowing arrogance and not being arrogant, knowing lying and not doing it, knowing the precepts and not following, going against the precepts. Knowing all, he just listed 44 behavior patterns that by their very nature cause harm, and that you know those 44 and you do not do it. And so that is what generates effacement. So it's not just, are we still and are we cultivating a level of meditation? It's also, are we cultivating a level of discernment that knows harm such that the mind that you are cultivating will not cause harm? And that, to me, is the only place you can do that is with a tiny little egoic mind that has the ability to be mindful of harm and not harm. So that's what I think this picture is beginning to help me see, that part of our control is taking this picture, our image of what we think mindfulness is, or we think an awakened mind is, and force it upon us into our boxes. But equal to that is, we have the ability to see when that control is not necessarily the most helpful, and when we can see when our behavior is harmful. And that's part of what I think this struggle we have to learn to see. In this struggle, we have to learn to see the edges of our assumptions about what practice is, assumptions about what an awakened mind is, assumptions about what we can and cannot do, or who we should and should not be, and all of that. We have to start letting go of a lot of the assumptions that we carry about this practice and become more and more and more connected to the present moment and doing no harm. The three right intentions, which is being as kind as we can, doing no harm, and willing to live with restraint. And that behavior, that intention, is what leads us closer and closer to, you could say, a wise awakened being. Because there are many awakened beings that you're questioning how wise they are.